Hi, this is Margot. This is Friday, March 17th, 2017, and I have on the line with me today Dr. Guy McPherson. And Dr. McPherson, and he just likes to go by Guy, is the world's leading authority on abrupt climate change leading to near-term human extinction. A lot of people have heard of him, and a lot of people haven't heard of him. I found him a few months ago and found his website, GuyMcPherson.com, and he has a radio show called Nature Bats Last Radio Show. And he talks about how we are on the verge of very abrupt climate change and the extinction of the human race, along with a lot of other species on the planet. And he's been doing his research for a very long time. He's got a Bachelor of Science in Forest Resources, Master of Science in Range Science, and PhD in Range Science. And so he knows his stuff, and he's been researching this for a very long time. He is Professor Emeritus from the University of Arizona, in Tucson, Arizona. And so, Guy, welcome to the show. Thank you for coming today.
Thank you, Margo. It's a pleasure to chat with you today.
Well, I'm just so pleased to have you here. And you're in Belize now. You moved down to Belize. How's the weather down there?
It's perfect, as it almost always is during the dry season this time of the year. So, it's mid-70s, it's a nice little breeze, it's partly sunny skies, it's pretty much the perfect day.
Yeah,
which, when you think about it, most of our days are pretty perfect. Those of us who live in the privileged global north civilization.
Yeah.
So we should recognize that we were never promised another day, and that each day is really pretty much perfect, because we get to be here.
Yeah, and you know, we have to look at our gifts and, you know, take advantage of what we're blessed with and what we can do rather than what we can't do. So give me a little background about how you really got into or interested in and really found out about the abrupt climate change, and then how your life changed after that, and we'll go from there.
Well, I had been studying climate change since I was a graduate student at Texas Tech University in the early 1980s. And at that time, relatively little was known about anthropogenic climate change. We knew that, of course, humans were responsible for what's called the greenhouse effect, mostly because of burning carbon dioxide. And there are other greenhouse gases as well. And I was studying climate change at that time from the perspective of paleoecology, looking in the past at the events corresponding with recruitment or die-off of plant populations. So I was looking in the past at significant climatic phenomena that helped explain populations of plants. And then I kept up with that line of thinking as a field biologist, ultimately as a conservation biologist. And conservation biologists are interested in extinction, speciation, or how species come into being, and habitat, the habitat requisite to support the continued persistence of a species on the planet. So those are really the three legs the three pillars of the enterprise known as conservation biology: extinction, speciation, and habitat. And so I'd been studying habitat for a long time. Then I took on a book with a colleague, an edited collection. We gathered a bunch of chapters from various individuals about the impacts of precipitation on plant populations in the past and projecting into the future. And so it was really the first synthetic look at precipitation as a major player in the global climate change that is underway and is sure to come. Up till this point, temperature had been the primary influence that people had been studying. What impacts will rise or have on ecosystems? Well, my colleague and I were in Tucson, Arizona, and we've been studying relatively dry ecosystems for a long time. And it was obvious that precipitation is the major driver behind ecosystem function in those systems. So we were interested in precipitation. So we put together this book, which was published in 2003. But it was in 2002 when I was collating these authors, all those contributed authors, that I realized we have triggered events that seem to me almost certain to cause extinction of the human race by 2030. And that was 2002, so that was a long time ago. And I was so indoctrinated by the system, so much a part of the system, so much dependent upon the system for my own livelihood, for my salary, that I just tucked that information away, never talked about for years. And it's only been within the last 5 years or so that it's become clear that I was too conservative in my conclusion at that point, and that we almost certainly do not last that long as a species. Came up with the conclusion I reached largely through intuition, and it's a little embarrassing for a scientist to say that they reached a conclusion based on intuition, but there you have it. Looking at all this evidence at that time and the synthetic material that been put together, and it appears that that was pretty much right on track, that we don't have long. And that climate change that is already underway and is certain to occur within the next decade or less will eliminate all habitat for our species on this planet.
Right, and I've heard your other interviews where you say the same thing. And every time you do a new interview, it's like, well, we have even less time than the last time that you were on the air with somebody due to other factions and things like Fukushima and who knows what. How do you think Fukushima has played into this, and is it playing a big role in the abrupt climate change?
Well, it indicates the interaction between triggers as nuclear power facilities and climate change, most notably abrupt climate change. It's the warming of the ocean that causes the huge events, the super storms of my grandchildren, James Hansen warned about in his 2007 book. These are the kinds of events, the tsunami that resulted in the collapse of the reactors at Fukushima Daiichi are emblematic of the changes underway and sure to continue into the future. We get a slight rise in sea level. There are many, many nuclear power facilities around the world, right on the coast. You get a little rise in sea level, you add energy to the system, the global system, and that causes the tornadoes and the hurricanes and the typhoons to be worse than they were before. And so that's obviously a prescription for disaster. So now we have a storm that comes along and wipes out a nuclear power facility, causes the meltdown, causes the backup generators to run out of diesel or gasoline, and an inability to refill them. And there you go. We're done. We have events like Fukushima and all kinds of others, an inability to provide service for those nuclear power facilities around the world as a result of economic decline that's underway, economic contraction, and also climate change that's underway. So all of these things interact with each other. This is the earth-like sweater that we cannot pull a single string out of without causing the whole sweater to unravel. With some sweaters, you can pull a thread and the thread comes out and it's no big deal. And then every once in a while, you pull that thread from the sweater and it causes the sweater to completely fall apart. And that's where we are with planet Earth. We're pulling too many threads, and the
whole system is bent, so to speak. And here we go, that thread's about to be pulled out as well.
Right, I get that. I totally understand that. And you've talked in other interviews in the past about these self-feeding loops that just keep going round and round. And so there's really nothing we can do to stop it, because if we stop living as a civilization, it heats up even faster than if we kept everything going the way it is and different things.
Yeah, these self-reinforcing loops have been triggered. There's no stopping abrupt climate change. The methane has been released. Global dimming alone, or rather the absence of global dimming, is undoubtedly sufficient to cause our own extinction. If we stop the omnicycle heat engine known as energy, because of the rapid heating associated with the loss of global dimming, if we keep the omnicycle heat engine of civilization going, well, that's going to kill us too. So we're truly in this position. Damned if you do and damned if you don't. We're done. I don't see there being a human being on the planet 9-10 years from now, maybe not even considerably less time than that, because of so many. I mean, habitat is running out already and is likely to be all gone in the not-too-distant future when we experience an ice-free Arctic and the methane really starts spewing out of the Arctic Ocean. And we're, you know, basically done. And we still keep the pedal to the metal, keep going faster, even though we're already over the cliff. We haven't really noticed yet. We're jockeying for the best seat, the best view on the way down as we go over the cliff to our own demise.
Right. And why do you think people are so resistant, and the public and the powers that be, they're so resistant to hearing this message? And I mean, you've been talking for a long time, and I know you tried to get other colleagues on board, but then that didn't work out. And what's the big deal about trying to get the truth out there?
Yeah, I think it was Will Rogers, the pundit and writer, who said, if you tell the truth, ride a fast horse.
Yeah.
Because that's the deal.
Yeah.
Some people can't handle the truth. And the truth hurts. We've all heard that expression as well. Sometimes the truth hurts, so we don't want to tell the truth. I don't think any mainstream scientist who works in the arena of climate change could say and write what I'm saying and writing and remain supported in his or her job. I'm not saying they would be fired. I'm saying they would lose support. So they might lose grant money. They might lose the ability to teach their courses, and they might lose the ability to recruit graduate students. But you can't transmit the message I'm transmitting, which is that civilization itself is an omnicidal heat engine. You can't talk about that if you're embroiled within civilization and depending upon civilization for your water and your food and your paycheck and your privilege. You can't talk about, you know, I wrote relatively recently that civilization is a wrecking ball in a crystal factory. And when it comes to pointing out the downside of civilization, I'm a proud wrecking ball in a crystal factory. But if anybody were being paid to point out that this set of living arrangements is a wrecking ball in a crystal factory, they wouldn't be paid for very long, because nobody wants to hear that.
No,
nobody.
No, you're absolutely right. And we've been lied to on so many different arenas. Yeah. And this is just one of the fronts, but it's a major one. And you know, you're my hero for going out there and putting yourself out there and saying to hell with what happens. You know, I feel like I need to get this out there because I know it's the right thing to do, and I have a moral obligation to let people know. And I kind of have a feeling that's how you feel. Am I right?
Yeah, it's almost as if you've been reading my work.
Yeah, I have been. Yeah, because at some point you have to live with yourself, and you have to walk the talk. Walk the talk.
Right.
And otherwise, if you don't walk the talk, you're just a hypocrite, and you're not any better than any other lying bastards out there. So.
Well, yeah, there's, you know, not to put too fine a point on it, I would have to agree with you. But it's hard, you know, and it's also difficult to predict the future with much accuracy. So most people who know what I know are taking a much more conservative and safe approach from the perspective of keeping their job and maintaining the privilege. You know, and I'm not sure I would do what I did knowing what I know today, because talking about anarchism, which is what ultimately caused my departure from the University of Arizona, talking about that and talking now about abrupt climate change leading to human extinction in the near term, those conversations have been detrimental to the relationships that I valued in my life. They have made it difficult for me, essentially impossible, to draw a paycheck, which I haven't done for about 8 years now. And so I'm not sure that I would actually pursue the evidence with the same kind of vigor that I have if I could turn back the clock 10 years, given what has happened to my personal life in that period of time. So it's easy for me to understand why people are not following my lead who are in mainstream positions, because they saw what happened to me.
Yeah,
I was destroyed.
Yeah,
I was shattered. Every relationship in my life fell apart.
I've experienced that too, with different things that I've been into and my experiences and stuff. And I found that your friends and family who you thought would stand by you no matter what, when the going gets tough, they really don't.
Yeah. When the going gets weird, the word weird turned pro, as Hunter S. Thompson said. But when the going gets tough, you lose a lot of people along the way.
You do. And so that's where you have to find your own inner strength and inner guidance to just keep moving forward, and then know that somehow the universe will support you if that's what you're wanting to get out. And there will be new people along the way who will be your friends and who will support you and, you know, help you as you're in the lifeboat trying to go around and throw out lifesavers of information to people. So,
right. And even if there are no lifeboats, pointing out that there are no lifeboats seems like a moral obligation to me.
I agree. So,
and yes, I have come across people who have become dear friends as a consequence of the decisions I've made. If I were to maintain the balance sheet, the numbers were much higher in my favor back in the good old days when I was a beloved professor on campus. But I have dear, true friends with me today, and that ultimately is what matters. All of us die alone. But it's nice to know that in those final days, final hours before my death, that I will have people around me who actually love me for what I do and what I am.
Right. And that's important. That's so important. And a lot of times the friends that you develop later on are closer than your blood relatives or old friends and stuff, because they know who you are and where you are right here, right now, and they just embrace you for that.
Ultimately, it's not the number, it's the quality. It's not the quantity, it's the quality of the relationships and the experiences in your life. It's, you know, like the old saying goes, it's not the number of years in your life, it's the amount of life in your years.
Right.
And so that's the way I'm trying to live today, knowing full well that I won't live as long as my parents, for example.
Right. And, you know, people don't want to change. They are so resistant to change And we've also been programmed to think that we have to keep living no matter what, even if we're on our deathbed and, you know, with tubes down us and not able to eat and speak or anything, that's better than dying. But I disagree. I think there are things worse than death.
Absolutely. Of course there are things worse than death. Everybody dies anyway. It's not the death that bothers me. It's the suffering that is to be encountered along the way. And I think most people who have thought about it for more than 3 minutes would agree that they're going to die. They know they're going to die. But nobody wants to suffer. And the suffering is what I'm trying to allow people to avoid or to minimize in their final months, years, days with my message. Because minimizing suffering can result when you come to grips with this message. If you're ignorant going into abrupt climate change and you don't know what it means to lose habitat for your own species and you die ignorantly, that can be really, really filled with suffering because things will be happening and you won't have any explanation for it. So you'll be confused and crazed and blaming other people and really wondering what's happening to you. Whereas I have a pretty good idea what's going to happen to me. I know that I'm going to die. I know that it's not going to be very long from now. And I'm living differently than I otherwise would be in light of that situation. So if other people are willing to join me, I suspect they will at some level encounter that same way of living instead of making a living. They can focus on living. So that's why I continue to do my work, which a lot of people find unnecessary. So there you go.
Right. Well, let's talk a little bit about how you see the abrupt climate change happening. Will it be kind of like The Day After Tomorrow, that movie where it happens like really fast within a couple of days, or do you see it happening differently in different parts of the world just depending on what happens, or have you thought about that?
Yes. This is what I think about.
Okay.
So I have thought about it.
Okay.
And it clearly is not going to play out in the form of Day After Tomorrow, a movie that came out, I think, in 2003 or 2004, because we're already in the midst of abrupt climate change, and it is not playing out over a span of 2 days. We've been in the midst of abrupt climate change for several years now, perhaps even a decade, and not everybody died in 2 days. There are a lot of people dying because of loss of habitat in islands in the South Pacific. And there are a lot of people fleeing those islands as well. And there are a lot of people dying in the Middle East and Northern Africa or becoming refugees and departing those places. So the suffering is already underway and has been underway for a few years. Will it continue? Will it become exacerbated? Yes, absolutely. And I think really quite quickly it could get much, much worse. Because of these self-reinforcing feedback loops, because of the loss of global dimming, we stop putting particulates in the atmosphere because we're in the age of economic contraction and we know that all civilization reached their end and on and on and on. So there's so many of these interacting factors all pointing to potentially a very high temperature rise at the level of the planet within as little as 16 months from now, and certainly within 3 or 4 years, it's difficult for me to imagine habitat for humans on this particular planet. And that means that the survivors will be living in bunkers, eating canned peaches, and hanging on for another day, another week, another month. And to be clear, I don't think that's living. I think that's dying a little more slowly. So I'm not pursuing that route myself.
Right. Well, what do you recommend people do to prepare? We've got physical, emotional, and then some different things too, like legal things. Do you think people should go ahead and get their wills made out and have a living will and things like that, or?
I think people should have their affairs in order, yes, and I think that applies at many, many different levels. Mm-hmm. The legal level, the psychological level, the emotional level, the personal level. So here's one example. I went to a 4-day grief recovery workshop and was certified as a specialist by the Grief Recovery Institute in January of 2014. And one of the things I learned there was that grief, which we don't think about and we certainly don't talk about in this culture, grief results from an incomplete relationship. And think about that for a minute. If you know your grandmother is dying, and you know that she has somewhere between 2 and 6 weeks to live, and as a consequence, you spend a lot of time with her, you have the conversations that you never have had with her, and you reach fulfillment with her, you say everything that you wanted to say, and you hear everything she wanted you to hear, and then she dies, then the grief is minimal. If, on the other hand, your grandmother dies unexpectedly a week before you were going to go visit her, and you had so many things you wanted to say to her, you wanted to say that you loved her before she died, you wanted to thank her for providing your favorite pancake recipe, she had so many things she wanted to say to you, and you could have learned so much from her. So in that latter situation, you missed out. That's an incomplete relationship. Your grandmother died, and your relationship with her was incomplete. And as a consequence, you grieve because there were things left unsaid. So one of the things I encourage people to do is complete those relationships, all of them. Say the things that need to be said. Sometimes, however, the relationship is too difficult to complete in person, or because of distance or because of the nature of the relationship. And so in that case, there are things you can do within your own heart, within your own mind, and with your own piece of paper and pencil, and writing letters and completing exercises, and somehow reaching the end of that relationship. I'm not suggesting that those relationships be terminated, just that they become different relationships. So, for example, if your ex-partner from 6 years ago, if you're still angry with that person because of things that were left unsaid, maybe it's time to say them. Or maybe it's just time to write down the reasons you're angry with them, write them a letter of apology and never send it. Achieve some way of reaching closure with that person, with that situation. Still maintain a relationship, but the relationship might change. That ex doesn't know. You don't send the letter, but you've reached completion. You've reached closure, and now the relationship can be changed. You can be friends with that person. You don't have to hold on to the anger anymore. This is a classic case of application of the Zen saying, let go or be dragged. So let go of that old relationship. Create a new relationship, however superficial it need be, with that particular person, and move on. And I think it's time for a lot of us to move on to a different kind of relationship with people, with the living planet, with our own selves, and our own Carl Jungian-style shadow. It's time to emotionally come to grips with the fact that we all die, that all species go extinct, and that our time is not too far off. Deal with it. Live with it, and then live. Don't focus on the dying. Focus on the living. That's the important part, is to live fully in light of the situation, in light of the urgent nature of the situation.
And how do you help people, like if they've got a lot of anger about what's gone on in the world and you know, they're blaming, you know, the powers that be, and they blame the government, they blame the politicians, and, you know, things like that. How can they let go of that anger and realize that there's nothing really anybody can do, even if we knew, even if we could get them to stop doing stuff and to turn things around, it's really too late.
Right. So that's one of my taglines is remain calm. Nothing is under control. It's certainly not under your control, certainly not under my control. And I don't think under the control of the governments as well. Let go of the notion that anybody in any position is going to do anything to improve the situation. You're going to die. You've known that since you were 11. Our species is going to go extinct. Every conservation biologist knows that. It's only a question of timing. Remain calm. Nothing is under control. That might be giving the benefit of the doubt to some people who were never calm to begin with. But I'm willing to go that route to assume that everybody is at some level calm or is capable of achieving a calm perspective. So that's one of the things that we have to do. That's consistent with that Zen notion, let go or be dragged. Remain calm, nothing is under control. And then you can get on and live your life. The government isn't in control of anything. And if you're depending upon the government for your own life, I think you have issues that I can't overcome, that are beyond your shrink or me or anybody else to deal with. You need to live your own life. You need to take responsibility for yourself and for the people around you, not rely upon the nanny state for things like food and water and providing a living for you. That's asking too much to ask anybody, much less government entities, to assume responsibility for that which is truly yours.
Right, I agree. And what gets me is, you know, this situation is so dire, and there are other dire situations too, but this is probably the biggest one, and they all play in together, is why don't people realize it? And, you know, they're fighting, and what's the use in fighting and going to war, or even fighting about who's elected president, or who's, you know, who's got the most money, or, you know, it just makes no sense to me, guys.
Well, yeah, I think that's an affliction with the dominant paradigm. People are afflicted with the dominant paradigm, and they have been their entire lives, because why not? The dominant paradigm, the dominant narrative, the voice whisper in your ear is telling you that money is what matters. That's what gives you power. That's what gives you privilege. So you chase the dollar, and you don't really notice who gets kicked out of the way, who gets trampled, who gets shot, who gets killed as a result of you getting that next dollar. You don't really notice that the brown people in Africa are being killed at a wedding because you turn on the lights. You need the oil to turn on the lights to maintain the well-greased system that is industrial civilization. You know, crude oil is the lifeblood of industrial civilization. And when you take out a pint of blood from your body, you get a little laggard for a while. When you take out two or you take out three, you don't persist much longer. Well, the same thing happens with crude oil. When we remove a little bit, the system slows down. When we remove enough, the system stops. And so to maintain the set of living arrangements in the United States and Europe, especially Western Europe, in the global north, New Zealand and Australia, we have to take a finite material, crude oil, and we have to get it. We have to make sure that we keep getting it. And the consequences are known as collateral damage, even when they include genocide. I'm not a fan. I recognize that it's going on. I recognize that it's beyond my control. I recognize that because war is a racket, it will keep going until there are no people left on the planet. So having that knowledge is not necessarily helpful for me, but it reminds me that some people are terminally afflicted with a serious case of the dominant paradigm, and there's no letting go for them. I try not to fall into that category myself, but I suspect I do every now and then, more often than I would like.
Well, and most of us have to be in the system to a certain point to even live. I mean, look at us right here. We're on Skype together, and if we didn't have the technology, we wouldn't be doing this interview right now.
That's right. You're absolutely right.
It's a dichotomy. You know, here we are saying, well, industrial civilization is killing us, and yet we have to have it. We don't really know how to live without it.
At two levels, we need it. At the level of individuals, we almost all need it because it allows water to come through the municipal taps, because it allows groceries to be delivered at the grocery store, and so on. And I tried about 10 years ago to walk away from this set of living arrangements. I established a homestead in New Mexico where I could attempt to grow all of my own food and so on, create a human community that was decent and loving. That was before we knew a lot about abrupt climate change, before we knew much based on the Referee Journal literature about global dimming and its impacts on cooling the Earth. So now we know that not only do a majority of the people on the planet depend upon industrial civilization for food and water and medicine, but in addition, we all, every single one of us, depend upon industrial civilization for habitat. If industrial civilization goes away, the particulates fall out of the air within a matter of a few days, most notably sulfates from burning poor quality coal. And when that happens, the Earth heats up catastrophically in a very short period of time, and all habitat is lost for every human being on the planet in a very, very short period of time. As little as days. And so that the next growing season after that, there's an inability to produce grains at scale, and bam, suddenly there's no food in the grocery stores. None. So, you know, at two levels, at the level of the individual and at the level of habitat for our entire species, civilization must be maintained or we're all dead. And yet, maintaining civilization is a horrible thing because it is responsible for the extinction of 150 to 200 species a day, according to a 2010 report from the United Nations, August 2010. That's 150 to 200 species a day going extinct as a result of industrial civilization. And industrial civilization is the heat engine that continues to heat the planet. Industrial civilization is responsible for the fouling of the air and the dirtying of the water and the washing away of the soils into the ocean, and on the list goes. Industrial civilization is horrible, and without it, we all die. Oh, how inconvenient.
Right. So, you know, it's a catch-22. That's all there is to it.
Yes, it is.
So talking about having a homestead and growing all your own food, that's not easy to do. I've gardened in the past and composted and everything, and it's not easy to do. And these people who think they're just gonna like leave the city and buy a little plot of land and set up a trailer and live off the land, I think they're gonna have a rude awakening. I mean, you've got to know what you're doing, and especially if you have a bad growing season, you planted all your seed and then nothing grows, you know, you're screwed.
Yeah, absolutely. I found that, you know, as a lifelong academic, I found moving to a homestead in New Mexico, rural New Mexico, that it was very, very challenging for me to learn how to grow food. When I started that project, I could barely distinguish between a screwdriver and a zucchini, and there I was building a bunch of structures and trying to grow a bunch of food. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, it's hard. It's not impossible. I came to grips with it and was able to grow all the food I needed, with the exception of grains, within a couple or 3 years. So it's not impossible. But those are the good old days. Those are the days when we were experiencing slow linear change, when we were not in the midst of abrupt climate change. It's more difficult every year to grow the plants we need to survive. So it's not going to get any better. It's only going to get worse. Temperature going to continue to rise. We are not going to be able to grow grains at scale. Civilization will collapse. That's going to warm the planet beyond which anybody is going to be able to plant a garden and expect to get something out of it. The system is just too unstable for that already in many places, and certainly going forward into the not too distant future.
Yeah, it's almost like we need to be living in domed cities. Right. Fears we could control the environment inside somehow, but we never got there.
Right. And again, I would argue that that's not really living.
Yeah.
You know, that was attempted at Biosphere 2 in Oracle, Arizona, not far from Tucson, where I was living. Right. And it turned out to be an unmitigated disaster. There were millions and millions of dollars thrown into that project. And the 8 Biospherians that were in there for 2 years, all of them lost a lot of weight and were virtually starving to death. And they had to open the port every week or so to take in really important stuff like food. And that was a situation where they had access to an infinite amount of fossil energy to maintain the system. Well, that's not the world we're headed into, is it?
No, it's not. It's not. And there's going to be so much radiation unless we can accommodate to that. And I guess some animals can, but, you know, most humans die when they're exposed to too much radiation.
Of course. Ionizing radiation from the meltdown of nuclear power plants will cause lethal mutations to arise as a result of ionizing radiation spewed all over the globe. But I doubt we have to worry about the multi-generational horrors associated with those lethal mutations. I think we will lose habitat in a far shorter period of time than several generations. And instead, we will be dealing with a situation like the Great Dying of 252.2 million years ago, but far, far worse. During the Great Dying, almost all complex life on the planet, almost all what we recognize as animals and plants today, went extinct. And that heating event, transpired over somewhere between about 900 and about 19,000 years. We're headed for a similar rise in temperature in a span of a decade or so. It's difficult for me to imagine any complex life, multicellular big animals like human beings, will survive that. That just seems insane to me, that we can continue to foul our planet and superheat the Earth in a short period of time and expect to maintain habitat for our favorite species.
Right. I agree. And I've heard you say in other interviews, when the interviewer asks, you can't give us any hope. And then you say, I've given up on hope. Tell us about that.
Ultimately, I'm hope-free. I view hope and fear as the twin sides of the I don't know the future coin. And so since I don't know the future, I'm going to fear the future and negate any responsibility for it. I'm just going to fear it, what they are going to do to me, what the future, what fate holds for me. Or I'm going to hope for the best. I'm going to think positive. I'm not going to do anything. I'm just going to think positive and hope for the best, and it'll all work out all right. Because if you just think positive, everything's going to be better. No, it's not. That's hope and fear. Those are the twin sides of the I don't know the future coin. So I'm going to emote about this future over which I've abandoned any responsibility. I'm not going to do anything. And both of those seem equally absurd to me. I no longer hope. I no longer fear. I live. Oh, that's a four-letter word, too. But it's one I like. So in light of an uncertain future, the only certainty for which is that I die and the species I'm a part of goes extinct, I'm choosing to live and live fully with the people I'm with the ecosystem I'm with, and trying to protect that ecosystem and the emotions of the people I'm with.
Right. And I think, you know, so many people have been brainwashed into having this hope and having this idea that, oh, it's going to be a new day and, you know, something's going to save us. But in reality, nothing saved us yet. So why do we think that all of a sudden, you know, some kind of huge thing is going to happen? You know, it hasn't happened yet.
Right. And what is it? What is it that would save us? Is it the government? Is it aliens? Is it an invisible man in the sky? What's going to save us? That's the part that I don't understand. It's always something that is amorphous, undefined. I can't tell you what it is, but surely we can't go. Surely somebody or something is going to step in and make sure that our species persists for a while longer. Why? Why would we think that? Why? Yeah. How can you imagine that you can foul your nest every single day and not at some point manage to get poop on your feathers? That doesn't make any sense.
No, it doesn't. And no matter what people's belief system is, it just comes down to cold, hard reality.
Yeah, but cold, hard reality is cold and hard. And so I can understand why a lot of people don't want to go down that route, because it's cold and it's hard. So hope seems like so much better than just, quote, giving up, whatever giving up means. It seems so much better to most people to just imagine that somebody else will fix it and I don't have to do anything. So I'm just going to think positive about that.
Yeah. You know, and I've had this underlying kind of like sadness, or I don't really want to call it a big depression, but it's a sadness that I've had for about 10 years, knowing that something was really bad wrong. But I really couldn't put my finger on it until the last couple of years, when I really saw the environment going downhill. And then when I heard your interviews, I'm like, okay, that's what it is. I knew we were in big, big trouble, but I didn't know how big of trouble we were. And I was always, until I really heard your explanation of everything and the research that you've done, I kept thinking, well, you know, we could do something, or I could do something. But then once I heard some of your interviews, it was real calming to me, because I could just let go, and I could not have guilt about not having recycled more. You know, I could just let go of my guilt and let go of the idea that I could do anything to make a difference, and know that all I can do is really take care of myself at this point.
Relax. Nothing is under control. Let go or be dragged. I think you said it all there. I'm not trying to impose guilt or shame on people. I think we're in the midst of the sixth mass extinction.
We are.
I don't think there's any doubt about that at this point. And all species go extinct, and during mass extinction events, the big complex organisms that rely upon so many other organisms for their own survival, like, say, humans, are the ones that go extinct first. So, again, pursue love. Pursue excellence in a culture of mediocrity. There will not be any external reward for that, but you still get to look yourself in the mirror at the end of the day and tell yourself, I did all right. I did all right today. And that's worth something.
Right. And also, you know, don't stay in relationships that are harmful to you, or jobs that are just bringing you down and that are harmful and making you ill, because time is too short. It's too short to be wasting your energy on, you know, this evil, dark reality where it's coming down anyway.
No, I couldn't agree more with that. It's just, life is short. You know, the world's oldest human being turned 117 years old in March of 2015. And when asked to ponder the first 117 years of her life, she responded with four words. It seemed rather short. She was 117, and she died a few weeks later. Yeah. And that was just putting a punctuation point on her message, that it seemed rather short. And my message, which is to live with urgency.
Right. And, you know, live your life in a non-harmful way without imposing your will on other people, and just do the best you can.
Right, and don't be attached to the outcome. Another Zen principle. So try to do what you can. Try to do the right thing. Try to live with excellence, with love. But don't imagine that you're not going to die. Don't imagine that your life won't bring suffering to others. You can try to minimize that suffering, and I think that's a good idea. But no guilt, no shame. At the edge of extinction, only love remains.
Right. Absolutely. And that's your new workshop that you're going to be working on and taking around the world, isn't it? Only Love Remains?
Yeah, we've been offering it. My partner in developing the workshop and I have developed the workshop over the course of the last 3 years, and we are launching it. We are hosting it here in Belize in mid-April. You can go to the Only Love Remains website, onlyloveremains.org, or you can go to naturebatslastguymcpherson.com for more information about that. And that workshop is intended for people who have come to grips with near-term human extinction and are trying to figure out what to do next, how to let go of the indoctrination that they've been exposed to their entire lives, how to move on with relationships with the living planet, with the individuals in their lives, how to maintain some semblance of psychologically and emotionally healthy psyche and relationships in light of this information. It's tough, and it's worth spending some time with people to remind you that you're not alone. And that alone, finding out that there are other people who are experiencing similar emotions, similar difficulties, is worth the time. And I hear from people on a very frequent basis that once they come to grips with the reality of their own imminent deaths and our own imminent demise, and they find people that they can talk to about it, that makes them far more healthy than they otherwise were. This message is not one of gloom and doom. This message is one of living with urgency and pursuing right action, liberated from the outcome of those actions.
Right, and I think that's real important, and I'm glad you're doing that. And so what do you have on your plate coming up in 2017?
Well, there's the Only Love Remain workshop here in Belize, April 13th and 15th, with a day for lots of homework by the participants on April 14th. Then I'll be doing a speaking tour in the San Francisco Bay Area, California, in late April, early May, extending that tour to Missouri for a few speaking events in early May. Then Western Europe, Eastern Canada, the Northeastern United States in August through November. Undoubtedly a few things I'm forgetting along the way. You can find all the information about that in constantly updated tab at GuyMcPherson.com, the coming events tab. So there's, I imagine I'll be keeping busy. And you can find out about all my busyness and how you can play a part in it at the coming events tab at Nature Bats Last.
Yeah, well, you are a busy guy, and I appreciate it. You know, you're doing this with a sense of urgency with, you know, all the people that you talk to, so I appreciate that. So your website is GuyMcPherson.com, and you've written quite a few books. Are they all available on Amazon, and are they in bookstores? Or?
Well, there's a tab, again, at GuyMcPherson.com called My Writing or My Books or something like that. So they're all available there, either from the publisher or from Amazon. I think they're all available to Amazon. Mm-hmm. I think there's 13 or 14 books there altogether, a couple of pieces of fiction, but mostly nonfiction, and most recently, Extinction Dialogues, co-authored with Carolyn Baker, that describes As the subtitle says, how to live with death in mind.
Yeah. Well, you know, when we were communicating before we did the interview, I said that, you know, I've had my own experiences in grief work, and I was a hospice volunteer for 2 years and would sit with people and help them when they were going through the dying process. But it's interesting, before I got into that, I was working in a nursing home for a while as an activities assistant, and I started having dreams about some of the residents before they would die. And I would have a dream about a certain resident. They'd be asking me where the cafeteria was or asking directions, and I would give them directions. And then within about a week, that person would die. And it kind of freaked me out at first, but then I noticed the pattern. And so whenever I would have a dream about someone, I would make sure and go to their room and visit with them and talk to them. And sure enough, within a week, they would be gone. So, you know, this is not, death is not anything to be afraid of. You know, we just cross over. We just drop this bodysuit and cross over to another reality. And it's very close. It's not that far away. It's very close. And, I think, you know, a lot of people have had near-death experiences and, you know, can attest to seeing that there's something else. And if you've had experiences like that, it's not as frightening, too.
Right. Yes. So, and in addition, even if you take a more secular approach and assume there's nothing that follows, well, then I was not here for millions of years, and then I showed up for a few years, and then I'm not here again for another few million years. And the whole time I've been here, I didn't miss those millions of years when I wasn't here. So we're here now. And as Ed Abbey, the Southwestern writer, liked to say now and then, Nirvana is now. Let's be here now with the ones we're with.
Right. Very good. Okay, so we'll wrap this up, Guy. Are there any last-minute things you want to say to the people?
Just I continue in my own life, and so to the extent my life can be an example for others, I continue to pursue excellence. I continue to pursue love in the way that I live, in the way I treat people and non-human species. And I continue to recognize that nothing is under my control. That allows me to live with urgency and to do what I want to do now, because now is what we have. Thank you very much, Margot. I appreciate the opportunity to chat with you today.
Thank you, Guy. I really appreciate it. And I wish you all the best in all your endeavors. And I'll be listening to you and checking out your website and all of the things that you'll be doing.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.